My name is Mary Tidmore, and I'm a very happy, very, very grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi. And I regularly attend the Albertville Al-Anon. So many A's I get this mixed up, I'm going to try again. Albertville Al-Anon, Al-Anon Family. Albertville, Alabama, Al-Anon Family Group. This is where I go. Only a few short years ago, I was not very grateful, nor was I very happy. In the last few months, I've become to realize more and more that the more grateful I am, it seems the happier I am. So I'm pretty well convinced by now that a great deal of my happiness depends on a great deal of my gratitude. When I first came to this Al-Anon program, one of the first things they said to me was that I could never hope to get any more from this program than I was willing to give to this program. And they said to me, too, if I was asked to do anything, that I should do it to the very best of my ability, regardless of how feeble that effort might be. That has been why, for the last few years, when I have been asked to go somewhere and stand up in front of a group such as you, and you are pretty, that I've generally said yes, knowing full well that my knees would be shaking and my heart would be pounding, and they are, and it is. But this is a very small price for me to pay, I feel, for what Al-Anon has given to me. I was the youngest child in a family of only two children. I had one brother. He was a little less than 2 years older than I, and he was killed in a motorcycle accident the year he was a senior at the University of Alabama. And this was before Neil and I were married. Our home as children was a very happy home. We lived on a farm. My father was a farmer. We did own our farm. We were not wealthy people, but I know now we were not poor people. We had all of life's necessities, and we had a few of life's luxuries. But for whatever that home might have been, it was not a home where there was any use of alcohol. As far as I've ever known, there was not an alcoholic relative in either of my parents' family. As a matter of fact, as far as I've ever known, there wasn't social drinking in either of my parents' families. When I grew up into a young lady and I was allowed to go out to the places that my parents called honky-tonks. Now, when Neil and I are riding around over the countryside now and we pass these places, out front the names is lounge and supper clubs and taverns and things like that, words that sound a great deal more sophisticated than the word honky-tonk. But I can assure you, if my parents were still alive, they would still be calling these places honky-tonks, because this was exactly the way they felt about these places. When I would be riding around as a young person, I didn't go to these places. Thinking about that now, I think perhaps the reason I didn't go, I was just too big a coward. Because I remember being with friends and we would pass these places and I would wonder, what does go on behind those darkened windows and those closed doors that I'm not allowed to know about? And yet I didn't slip off and go. But whatever my reason was, I don't know, but I didn't. So as a little child and as a young person, I lived a life that was totally sheltered from the effects of the use of alcohol. Now, I'm not really sure that that did a great deal to contribute to the way I reacted when I found myself married to an alcoholic or not. I have some Al-Anon friends that grew up in alcoholic homes, some of them abusive alcoholic homes, and they didn't react any better than I did. So I'm not really sure that that contributed, but nevertheless, this is the way it was for me. Neil came to see me one night before we were married when he was under the influence of alcohol. Now, I think maybe the reason he didn't come more than one time under the influence, we just didn't court that long. 3 months and 12 days from the night that I met Neil, we were married. When he carried me home that night, I told him not to come back. I didn't tell him not to come back because I had any idea what that alcohol could, would, and certainly was going to eventually cause in our lives. But I told him not to come back because I had been taught two things. The first one was that I was not to have anything to do with alcohol. And a very, very close second was that I was not to have anything to do with anyone that did have anything to do with alcohol. Knowing that he was drinking, I thought the proper thing for me to do was to tell him not to come back. And this is what I did. The next morning, Neil came to where I was working. He was no longer under the influence of alcohol. He was clean shaven. He had on clean clothes. And he looked real pretty to me because, you see, I had fallen in love with the old boy. And he made to me that morning what turned out to be the first of many, hundreds, most likely thousands of promises. I'm sorry, forgive me, I will not do this again. It doesn't seem very strange that I believed him that morning when he made that promise to me so many, many years ago. But what does seem a bit odd, even when I think about it now, more than 30 years later, he was still making that same promise to me, and I was still believing him. When I think about that now, after having been around Al-Anon for a few years and been to a number of open AA meetings, and I've heard many of the alcoholics, as they've shared their deepest feelings, their sincerest thoughts, and some of the critical drinking times, I have no reservations this morning telling you that I believe the reason that I did believe him over a period of more than 30 years, as he made that promise to me, was simply because he was absolutely sincere every time he made that promise. But because he suffers from a disease that we now know is alcoholism, he just could not physically keep that promise to me. Very soon after this, Neil and I were married, and that will be 40 years come the 24th day of September. And so from the very beginning of our marriage, Neil drank. He didn't drink very often in the beginning. I think he was what I hear you alcoholics refer to as a periodic drunk. I don't really know how much he drank because I was not with him generally when he drank. But I do know that every time that I knew that he drank, he got drunk. So perhaps then, had I known anything at all about the pattern of alcoholic behavior, even then, I might have known there was trouble ahead for me. But whether I could have or not, there was trouble at hand for me. I did not like Neil's drinking, and from the very beginning, I took every drunk that Neil had as being personally directed at me. Now, I don't remember that Neil ever told me he did or did not get drunk because of anything that I did or did not do. But I do remember many times he'd be coming off of a drunk, and I would say, "Neil, what did I do this time that caused you to get drunk?" Now, which one of you alcoholics sitting out there would not let someone else assume the responsibility of your drinking if they stood there and asked you for it? And this is exactly what I was doing. Now, he would just remember some little nitpicky thing that we had not agreed on just prior to his getting drunk, and he'd remind me of that. The monkey was off his back, and the monkey was on my back. And I carried this monkey around for many, many years. And I want to jump ahead here enough and tell you, when I came to Al-Anon, and you wonderful Al-Anon taught me that I was not responsible for his drinking, nor had I ever been, nor would I ever be, I felt as if chains of bondage had been clipped from my body. I will never forget the freedom that was mine when I knew I had not caused this drinking. The years of our marriage progressed, the drinking progressed, and my frustrations, my anxieties, my resentment, the self-pity, the whole bit progressed, I think, perhaps faster than did his actual alcoholism. And as I look back at those earlier years now, there's little doubt in my mind but that my reaction to his drinking in the earlier years had a much more serious emotional effect on our children than did his actual drinking. Neil was not an abusive drunk. He didn't beat upon the kids, beat up on me, break out the windows, or tear down the doors, or anything of that sort. As a matter of fact, he was a very quiet drunk in the beginning and probably would have stayed that way had I stayed quiet. In the beginning, I was quiet. Now, I don't really attribute that to any real special virtue on my part, but because of some circumstances that were not ours to control at the time, after the first 4 or 5 years of our marriage, my mother lived with us for the next 16 and a half years until her death. Knowing how she felt about people that drank and being naive enough to think that she didn't know what was going on, I thought if I stayed quiet, she just wouldn't know what was going on. And so I did stay quiet. But this was to change, and I'll get to that a little bit later. Something like 20 to 21 years ago, Neil came home from work one day and said he was going to AA. And I was thrilled to death. Now, I really didn't know a thing about AA. However, I had read everything that I could ever find anywhere that had one word in the title that, in my mind, I could relate to being drunk, drinking, or that sort of thing. Because I was sure somewhere on a printed page there was a formula of action that I could follow that would make him quit drinking. And I was totally obsessed with finding this. And so I read everything that I could find. Now, I didn't find this, you know that. But what I did find was that of all the programs that has been designed for and tried in the rehabilitation of the practicing alcoholic, no program has the statistical average of success that the AA program has. And so I was real pleased that he was going to AA. And two, this was the first time he had ever said one word that even suggested to me that he had any idea that this drinking was causing any problem at all in our home. Now, there was a full week that passed between the night that Neil went to his first AA meeting and the night that I was to get to go. He came home that first night and said, "You can go with me next time." The wives were there too. They sat in another little room. He did not say one word about Al-Anon, or if he did, I don't remember it. I had never heard the word Al-Anon in my life. And I had no idea why the wives went too. But I'm a real brilliant person, and I had a whole week to think about this, and I figured it out. I thought, well, you know, we'll ride to these meetings with our husbands. This way we'll know this is where they've really gone. And then we're going to be there when that meeting's over. We can ride home with them. This way they won't go by the bootleggers and get a bottle on the way home. And I suppose that while they sat in that little room that he said they sat in, that they would exchange dress patterns and recipes. And I thought there was a possibility that some of them might talk about their husband's drinking. But I had never talked about Neil's drinking with anyone, and I knew I would not be starting with this bunch of strangers. I've never known for sure whether that group was dead and they just elected to have the funeral after I came, or whether I killed it. But within a very short time, no more than 2 or 3 weeks at the longest after I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, that group discontinued meeting and did not meet again until 10 years ago, this past April, and I was instrumental in helping to get that group started again. And so there was to be an awful lot of years before Al-Anon once again crossed my path. And Neil's affiliation with AA at this time was very short-lived. And while there was no meaningful sobriety gained at that time, I have no doubt this morning but a little seed was planted then that lay dormant for many, many years, that once again, sometime later, was to grow in something very wonderful and very beautiful for us. But he didn't go to AA very long, and I didn't have an opportunity to go to Al-Anon for a long, long time. And in that lot of years, there was to be an awful lot of drinking, and I would sink to an emotional low almost indescribable. I tried everything that I could think of to make Neil quit drinking. I tried everything anybody else thought of if they told me. There was absolutely nothing that I would not have done to try to make Neil quit drinking. But the drinking continued, and it continued to get worse. And things in our home continued to get worse. And when I came to Al-Anon, one of the first things that I could hear echo was, "Be good to yourself." And I had no idea what they were talking about. And it was a long time before I could look back and realize that everything that I ever did to retaliate to Neil for his drinking hurt me a great deal more than it did me. I was the one that paid the price most of the time. He was drunk and didn't even know. I'm going to share with you this morning one little experience that will tell you some of the things that I did. And this is the kind of same thinking I did. A lot of times I could relate many, many stories like this. But this will give you a clear picture of the kind of thinking that I did. It always seemed to me that every time there was a special day coming up, a birthday, a holiday, anything that was to have been special for the family, Neil always got drunk. His very favorite time was the family vacation. Now, he would start his vacation 2 or 3 days before the family. I don't mean by that he left home before the family. He would start, and I like to borrow a little phrase from him here, and say he would start getting himself turpentined up for the vacation. And so by the time we were ready to leave on vacation, he would be about 3 sheets in the wind, and I would be so mad I couldn't stand myself, much less anyone else. And you know what sort of vacation this would be the makings for. And this is the kind of vacations we had. And pretty soon I got to where I wasn't too eager to go on vacation. But you don't ever get ahead of a drunk. He knew exactly why I didn't want to go. And he would say, let's go to the beach and I won't get drunk. And we did, and he didn't, until we got there. And then he would get drunk. A few times he did this, and the children and I, and by this time the children were getting a good bit larger, decided if we ever go anywhere else and Daddy gets drunk, we'll just leave him. No matter where we are, we'll just leave him there. Pretty soon we had an opportunity to do this. We went to Panama City. As a matter of fact, back then we didn't know anybody went anywhere on vacation except Panama City. And our pattern of going to Panama City was to get up kind of early in the morning and drive into the area, get there about lunchtime, and people would be checking out of their motels. Now, we never had reservations because we weren't sure we was going to get to go anywhere. And we had done this and had gotten a little efficiency apartment, and I was in the kitchen getting set up for us for the few days we were going to get to be there. And Neil came into the kitchen and says, I'm going down the beach just a little way and get some fish bait. So when we have had our lunch, the son and I can go fishing. And that sounded okay. Well, he wasn't gone but a few minutes. And until this day, I did not realize that anyone could get that drunk that quick. He wasn't gone but just a few minutes. And when he came back, he was so drunk, he could hardly stand up. And that afternoon, out in front of that motel, we had the loudest, the ugliest, the nastiest exchange of words that we ever had. And he got in that car and left again. Now, of course, we knew that he would be drunk for the rest of the vacation. So the children and I decided, well, this is the time to just leave him. We'll fulfill this promise we've made ourselves. Now, see, he had the car. I took an inventory of my purse, and I just barely had enough money to buy a bus ticket for the children and I. We have 2 children, a son and daughter, from Panama City to Albertville. And let me tell you, if you have not traveled from Panama City, Florida, to North Alabama by way of bus, it is really an experience. They don't go straight. We left Panama City about 3:30 in the afternoon. Now, it had taken all the money that I had to buy the tickets. I had $1 and it seemed like it was 27 cents left when I bought the tickets for us to come home. We left Panama City and we went to Tallahassee. We went from Tallahassee over almost to Jacksonville. Then we turned north and we weaved and twisted all over the southern part of Georgia. Got into Atlanta after daylight the next morning, had a layover in Atlanta, and got to Albertville after lunch the next day. Now, we're getting even with Daddy. Daddy has got the car. Daddy's got the money to buy anything he wants to eat. Now, 3 people don't eat a lot in 24 hours with $1.27. So we'd sit up all night on a bus, but we were getting even with Daddy. Now, all the things that we ever did to get even with Daddy, this is the way they hurt Daddy. And do you know, I learned later, it was 3 days after we left, before he even knew we had left. So we must have done a good job of getting rid of Daddy, even with Daddy anyway. 12 years ago, Neil came home from work once again and said he was going back to AA. There was no longer an AA group in Albertville, and we had to go to Gunnersville. And you people that are familiar with our area know it's only 10 or 12 miles from Albertville. Of course, I knew from the very beginning that I could go with him. In Gunnersville, I found a very small, but a very sincere, a very genuine, a very loving Al-Anon group, and they welcomed me with open arms. Those people could say the prettiest things I ever heard anybody say in my life. They talked about the slogans and they talked about the steps, and they talked about how they had been able to use those slogans and use those steps and the serenity that were theirs as a result of this wonderful program. And it sounded so good to me. And I would sit there and I'd think, you know, I bet that would work if he wasn't drinking. But in my mind, there was no way that I could think in terms of applying that to my life as long as he continued to drink. And yet there seemed to be a magnetism about those meetings that just kept drawing me back. I would have told you I really wasn't getting anything that I could use as long as he drank. But there seemed to be something that just kept drawing me back, and I kept going. And I'm so grateful this morning that I did, because I don't know why I kept going. I really didn't feel in the beginning. Well, actually, what I kept going for, I think, is I was sure, because most of them, their alcoholic was sober, and I was sure that they knew something, and eventually that's going to let it slip what they did to make this alcoholic quit drinking. And I was sure that one of them, one of these days, would let that slip, and I wanted to be there to hear that. And I think maybe that kept me going back for a long, long time, but of course it didn't work this way. And things were certainly getting a great deal worse in our home. As a matter of fact, our home was no longer a home. It was a house. And our lives, in no stretch of the imagination, could have been termed living. We existed, almost a robot-type existence, just doing the things that we had to do to exist. And there was no communication, and there was just an absence of anything that was good and anything that you could enjoy or anything that seemed worthwhile. But the sun came up every morning and went down every night, and things just continued to not get any better. And I began to realize that I was a very bitter person. I even began to realize that I was bitter with God. Now, I had been raised in the church, and I had been taught all the things that we're taught in Sunday school and church about God. And yet I felt a very deep bitterness because God was allowing this to happen in my life. I had always tried to be a good, decent, moral person. And it was something I couldn't understand. Why was God allowing this to happen to me? Now, I don't know how much you people believe when someone tells you they hear these little small voices. But I believe in this little small voice because I heard this little small voice one night very clearly. By this time in our lives, when Neil would be drinking, I had graduated to the guest bedroom. Now, maybe enough Al-Anon had soaked in that I had figured out this alcoholic that I'm married to, if he starts drinking this morning, he might be home tonight, and he might be home a week from tonight. And I think I had figured out that if I went into the guest bedroom and closed the door, I wouldn't be waked up when he came in, because he must have held his shoes up like this, because when he'd take them off, there was the loudest thud you ever heard when they'd hit the floor. And about the time he'd get still and you'd begin to get sleepy, he'd start fumbling and stumbling around to get up to go get something else to drink. And then about the time he'd settle down after that and you'd begin to get ready to go to sleep again, he'd fumble around to get up to go to the bathroom to get rid of some of that he'd been drinking. And it was just a continual thing. So I had figured out, if I went into the guest bedroom, that when I got up the next morning, that I could look in there and I could see if he had come home or not, and that if he didn't, someone would surely let me know. Now, up until very soon before this, I had been one of those wives that walked the floor all night and cried and looked out the window and wondered where he was and what he was doing and when he was coming home and who he was with and all that sort of thing. And as I think about now, the window that I stood and stared from endless hours, there's not even a street on that side of the house. I don't have any idea where I thought he was coming from. And yet I stood and stared from that window for many, many hours. But on this particular night, Neil had been gone, I don't remember how long, but several days. And of course I knew he was drinking. And I was in the guest bedroom, sound asleep. And all of a sudden this little voice said, just as clearly as audible to me as my voice is to any one of you right now, said, "Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And I sat straight up in that bed and looked around. There was no one in that room other than me. I got up and searched the other parts of our house. There was no one there other than me. And I took that night, and I still believe this morning, that this was the voice of God just offering me a little string of hope that I might could hang on to until things could and would get a little better in our lives. But here again, I was not willing to accept God's timetable, for this improvement was to come. And I thought what God was saying was when Neil came home this time and when he sobered up, that he wouldn't drink again. It didn't turn out that way. Neil drank again many, many times after that. And yet this was a little straw of hope that I was able to hang on to. Sometimes I'd get a long way from it, but my mind would float back to it. And it was a string of hope for me for a long, long time. But things were certainly not getting any better. And I began to realize that something had to change. Now, I have a job that I like very, very much. This job had been my security blanket through all the years. I did not know what was going to happen to Neil. I didn't know what was going to happen to us. But I had felt very, very secure in this job. As a matter of fact, I still do. Come the first day of June, 43 years ago, I went to work for, at that time, it was State National Bank, now it's Central Bank of the South. And I had felt very secure in this job, but I began to see some things happen that I knew could put this job in jeopardy. And I knew something in my life had to change. Of course, the first thing that I would like to have changed, and I would have told you if I could have made Neil quit drinking, that everything would have been fine. But I had learned by this time, I think, maybe I had subconsciously accepted that first step. I think I knew I could not make Neil quit drinking. And so the first possibility of change that I thought about, I had to forget about. I couldn't do a thing about that. That would have been the easy way out anyway, and it wouldn't have helped anything too much at that time. The second possibility of change that I thought about was a divorce. And I don't believe there's a person sitting in this room this morning that has lived in an alcoholic situation very long that at one time or another has not considered the possibility of getting a divorce. I remember many nights I would lay there and Neil would be out drinking. I wouldn't know where he was. And I'd think, this time I'm going to get out of it. I will not continue to live like this the rest of my life. And in my mind, I would pick out an attorney and I would make all my plans. I'd always make a mental list of what few material things we had. I was sure I was going to get my share of those. And finally, I'd be very comfortable with my plans. They'd be completely made, and I was comfortable with them, and I'd turn over and go to sleep. But when I waked up the next morning, I could never make myself follow through with these plans that I had made so carefully the night before. And so the second possibility of change I had to forget about. And then there was a third possibility of change that I thought about, and this was suicide. My family was all dead. Our children were grown and away from home, and in terms that you normally think of a child needing its mother, in my sick mind, I thought, well, they don't really need their mother anymore anyway. And so one afternoon, I was off from my job, and I took my pistol, and I got in my car, and I started driving. And in every vein of honesty there is in my body this morning, I can tell you I do not know where I thought I would go. And in that very same vein of honesty, I can tell you I don't know where I went. I drove the biggest part of the afternoon, and I suppose my subconscious mind must have been going over what you wonderful Al-Anon had said to me, maybe the events of my life for quite some time. But all of a sudden, I looked down, and I saw that pistol laying in the seat beside me, and it literally scared me to death. I knew that gun was loaded, and it absolutely mortified me. And all I wanted to do at that point was to turn that car and go home. And this is what I did, and put that gun where it belonged. I had only been home a very few minutes that afternoon, and our telephone rang, and it was our daughter. She lives in Birmingham. And she said, "Mother, where have you been? I've been calling you all afternoon." I said, "I've been outside. I would not have heard the telephone." She said, "Mother, what is wrong with Daddy?" I said, "I suppose he's drunk. Why?" She said, "Mother, Daddy called me this afternoon before he left to go to work." Neil worked at Republic Steel at that time and rotated, and that week he was on second shift. And she said, "Mother, Daddy was very upset when he called me, and he thought you were going to do something to yourself this afternoon, and he was very upset. And he told me to call you all afternoon. If you had not answered the phone by nightfall, for me to call him at the plant, and he would come home and look for you." Now, this was the man that I didn't think loved me enough to try to quit drinking. We talked for a few minutes. I assured her I was quite all right, and we hung up. And that afternoon, I walked out on our front porch and I sat down. And for the very first time, the wonderful things that you, Al-Anon, had said to me over and over for such a long time began to come through into my mind in a vein of thought that I could think in terms of applying to my life. I thought about the slogans, and when Dot said last night that she hung on to the slogans until she was able to work the steps, I think the slogans has been very special to me. But I remember that afternoon sitting on that porch and thinking that you people had told me, easy does it, and to think that I didn't have to do anything, certainly in any hurry, but to think. And you had told me to keep things simple. And you had told me to put first things first. And you had helped me to understand what first things first were. You had told me to live and let live. You had told me to live my life as best I could. But for me to allow my alcoholic to live his life however he chose to live his life, even if he chose to live his life as a practicing alcoholic. You told me to let go and let God. And I had not let go and let God. I had told God. I'd prayed many, many times. I told God exactly what I wanted him to do. And I told him exactly how I wanted him to do it. And almost without exception, I told him exactly when I wanted him to do it. And when things didn't materialize as I directed God have them be, I didn't think God was answering my prayers. And I could see, I knew, that I had not let go and let God do anything. I might turn loose for a moment, but I kept both hands reached out to grab it back. And you people told me one day at a time, and I had no idea what you were talking about. But then I began to realize that I had not lived any one day that God had given me. I either spent my day being angry and hurt and disappointed over something that had happened on a yesterday, or I spent my day anxiously awaiting some dreadful thing that I was absolutely sure was going to happen on a tomorrow, and I had not lived any one day that God had given me. I told you earlier, I think, that I had accepted that first step. I think I did accept the first step over a period of time, and I think I began to know that I was absolutely powerless over alcohol. I didn't have a great deal of trouble when I began to think at all with the second step, because I had been taught, I told you earlier, I'd been raised in a Christian home and carried to church, and I had been taught that power was there. And I began to realize that power had been there all the time. It was me that had moved. The third step said that I was to turn the will of my life over to that power. I think at this point, maybe I would have been glad to have turned it over to anything or anybody that I thought could do anything with it, because it was obvious to me that I certainly had not done too well. But I came to the fourth step, and to me, the fourth step was a hard step. It was a disappointment. It was a step that was depressing to me, because I could think and list all these terrible things that I knew about me. And one night in an Al-Anon meeting, we were having the four-step discussion, and one of the little ladies, and I think God so often puts little words in people's mouth and it pops out right exactly when you need it. And one little lady said, you know, this doesn't mean we just list the negative things in our lives, but we list the good things too. And most of us have some good things in our lives that we like about ourselves if we're honest enough to admit it. And this didn't balance the scales, but it made it look a little bit better. And eventually I was comfortable with the fourth step. I went on to the fifth, sixth, and seventh in that order, certainly not that fast, because I was a very slow learner. But I came to the eighth step. And the eighth step said that I was to make a list of all the people that I had harmed and become willing to make amends to them. I don't think I have ever been in an open discussion meeting in AA or Al-Anon when it hasn't been the general consensus of everybody there that most of the time we should put our name right on the top of that list. Most of the time we've harmed ourselves more than we've harmed anyone else. I've got to have some of that water now. But by this time, I had begun to be pretty good to Mary. I had begun to like Mary a little bit better, and I didn't feel a need of putting my name on the top of that list. Nor did I feel a real need of putting our children's name on the top of this list. Neither of our children seemed to be real seriously emotionally scarred from having lived in an alcoholic home with a crazy mother. But I felt very strongly that I should put Neil's name right on the top of that list. Neil was the only person that I ever wanted to hurt about anything. I remember many times when he would be hugging the commode and he would raise up, and I would look at him and I'd say, "Neil, I hope some way, someday, somehow, I can hurt you like you have hurt me." Little did I know then that even then he was hurting more than I was. Al-Anon has helped me to realize that, and Al-Anon has given me, through the ninth step, has given me the opportunity to make amends to him about that, and I do try on a continual basis. I never feel like I've got them completely made. If I have worked the first nine steps to the very best of my ability, I have gotten most of the garbage out of my life. If I work the tenth step, I will continue to keep it out, because it says continue to take a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. So the tenth step to me is a good housekeeping step once I have gotten it clean. If I have a step that I like best of all, if I have a favorite, it is the 11th step. I like to read the 11th step in the first person, and I like for it to, it says to me, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, praying only for the knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. I like to get up. I'm a morning person. I shared with somebody this morning. I wake up early every morning. I like to get a cup of coffee in my ODAT book. And where that job was my security blanket for a lot of years, this ODAT book is my security blanket now. And if I use it, the answer to most of my problems are there. If I'll just sit down and search for them, they're there. And I like to get up in the morning with my cup of coffee and my book. And almost without exception, I read or say that 11th step. I read my page for the day. And I like to sit quietly and just listen for God's direction for my life for that day. When I do this, things go a great deal better. Sometimes I'm careless. Sometimes I just don't. But my days are not nearly as good when I don't. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I would never suggest any change in the 12 steps. I think they're perfectly written and in perfect order. But for me personally, I have to work the second part of that 12th step before I can do anything with the first part. Excuse me. I don't think there'd be any way that I could carry a message to anyone unless I tried to the very best of my ability to practice the principles of this program in my life. What is it like now? This is where I kind of grope for words. The what it is like now was divided in two parts for me. The first one was what it was like for me when I began to try to work the Al-Anon program and my alcoholic was still drinking. When he came in, and I didn't tell you about the fits that I learned to have. You know, after my mother died and the children were away from home, I began to learn to have little fits. And I began to learn to say words that Neil didn't know I knew. And I began to say some words that I didn't know I knew. And I still don't know whether I used them in the proper context or not. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I could have some little wild tantrums. I could jump up and down and scream and holler and carry on pretty wild. And I remember one afternoon Neil came home, and he was very drunk, and he drug himself in the door. And I looked at him, and I did my thing, whatever it was. And he looked at me in that drunken stupor. And I hope I never forget this. He said, "Mary, you are drunker than I am, and you have not swallowed one drop of alcohol." And he was right. I was drunk on anger, on madness, on frustration, on rage. He had been drinking alcohol. What was my excuse? I did not have any. But anyway, when I began to try to work this program, and he was still drinking, when he came home, I no longer had these fits of rage. I didn't even feel an urge to. I could reassure him of my love. I could reassure him of my support. I could tell him how much I would like to help him, but how totally helpless that I was. And this I want to share just for the humor there is in it. Many times I had been to AA meetings, and I'd heard the alcoholic tell about getting to a point physically when they just could not go get the alcohol that their body cried out for. And they would tell about family members going and getting it and bringing it in. And I would sit there feeling very pious, and I would think, well, if he ever gets to that point, he'll just have to die. I won't go get it. But here again was one of God's little miracles. As long as I felt that way, Neil never got to the point physically that he could not go get the alcohol that he wanted and needed. But after Al-Anon taught me that he could need it, that it was out of his control, his feelings, and maybe he did have to have it, I did go and get it for him. Now, I'd never bought any alcohol in my life, and I did not have any idea what it cost. And I sure didn't want to be embarrassed when I got there and not have enough money to get it. So I carried $100 with me to buy one case of beer. I remember, after I learned what it cost, I thought, well, gee, that old boy could have ripped me off real good, and I wouldn't have known any difference because I would have just paid him whatever he asked for. But 9 years ago, this past November, Neil found the miracle of sobriety. With the help of the AA program and you wonderful AAs, he's been able to maintain that sobriety. In that 9 years, we have known of contentment, a peace, a happiness, and even a love that we didn't know existed for anyone, and certainly we didn't know existed for us. And if I told you how I feel about my life today, you'd think my life is a perfect utopia, and it's not. There's a lot of problems. There's living problems. There's a lot of things that Neil and I still cannot talk about. And yet, we both give the other one the right to feel about a situation however they do. We don't try to change the other one too often. And so it's just so much better in that respect. Now, we don't agree on everything, and I don't suppose that we ever will. But we see now so much beauty. I remember driving up, we came up yesterday morning and was a little disappointed there wasn't as many dogwoods in the woods as there had. I expected there to be. But several years ago in our forum, some lady had written in and she said, I now see more beauty in a weed beside the road than I saw before Al-Anon in a rose garden. And this is about the way it means for us. We see so much beauty in things that have been around us all these years. And the beauty was there then, but we just didn't look for it. We didn't see it. We built our home a few years ago right down in a clump of woods, down in a pasture, as a matter of fact. As a matter of fact, on that farm that I was raised on as a child. And we sit on that porch. We have a screened porch on the back, and we sit there, and there's rabbits and squirrels and all of God's little animals hopping around out in the backyard. And I'm sure they've been there all the years. But we didn't see them for such a long, long time. But now we see them and we enjoy them. And we have a swing in our front yard and under some trees. And we go out with a cup of coffee. And I shared with someone earlier, we've addicted our dog to coffee. So now Neil and I and the dog all have a cup of coffee out under the tree. And I don't know how many problems the dog solves, but Neil and I solve a lot with that cup of coffee out under the tree. Another thing that this program has given to us has been friends. Before we came to these programs, I'm sure Neil had friends, but they were drinking people, I thought, and I didn't want any part of them. And I let him know that, and I let them know that. And I had friends, but I didn't want to share them with Neil because I didn't want to be embarrassed with his drinking. This program has given us so many friends, so many places. And they love us, and we love them, and they mean so very much to us. I shared with someone, I think it was at supper last night, you know, when I first came around the program, and it was so obvious to me that the people that were there and had been there a while didn't do anything but AA and Al-Anon all the time. And I sit there and I thought, for my goodness, if this is all you're going to ever do, you know. It's just. But now, you know, I look back and I'm not sure what it was that I was so afraid I was going to have to give up. Because I believe that Randy maybe suggested it was that controlling. It was taking so much of the time with all that controlling. Maybe that's all we did have to give up. But anyway, our days are filled with much more pleasant things now. And I guess perhaps the greatest thing that this program has given to me has been the God that this program has given to me. Now, I was raised in the church. I've told you that. But the God that that church gave me was up there, and he had a notebook. And he was writing down all of the things that I did and did not do. And he was up there for me to call on for these big, major problems that I had. And he was a judgmental God. But this God that Al-Anon has given me is my buddy, and he's my friend. And he walks with me, and he holds my hand, and sometimes he carries me. And he's interested in my little problems, just losing one shoe, and you know you can't go out with just one on. He helps you find that. He's interested in the big problems too, and he's always there. And so there's no way this morning that I could get around to even beginning to tell you what Al-Anon means to me. But it means my life. I wouldn't have my life without it. It means my marriage. I know I wouldn't have my marriage without it. There's just no way to tell you what it means, but it means wonderful people like you. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I had reservations about coming because my nerves play tricks on me sometimes. And as Dot said, I brought my book, and I thought if I went blank, I'd just start reading to you. Because sometimes I have done just that. But I appreciate being invited up here. I thank all of you for listening. I thank all of you for your love. Come to Albertville and come to see us.